Senate Committee on Labor, Tuesday, February 3, 1981, 1 p.m., Hearing Room A. Hearing on Senate Bill 209 relating to deceased employee benefits to surviving spouse and dependents. Senate Bill 219 relating to discrimination in employment based on family relationship. Senate Bill 210 Wage and Hour Commission Special Permits for Minors. Senate Bill 211 Wage and Hour Commission relating to minimum wages for employees over 65 years of age. Senate Bill 212 Wage and Hour Commission relating to civil penalties and child labor.
The committee will come to order. The clerk will note those present. All others are excused. The first bill, 209. Mr. Hugo, Bruce, you're the only one signed up on four of the bills up today, so I'm going to take them in order. And another gentleman has signed up for 212.
Fine.
And why don't you start out with 209 first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to introduce to Chair in the committee, Mr. Paul Tiffany, who is the administrator of the Bureau's Wage and Hour Division. Four of these bills are concerned with wage and hour. On Senate Bill 209 modifies existing law regarding the disposition of wages due a deceased employee. In reviewing the history of this section of the law, it's obvious that the legislative intent has been to ensure that monies owed to deceased wage earner are paid to the wage earner's survivors as quickly as possible. The bill we have submitted for your consideration amplifies and clarifies this intent. Going through the bill, on line 6, page 1, we were suggesting that the dollar limit be deleted. After all, wages that are due should be paid as if the earner were still alive, regardless of the amount.
Bruce, mm-hmm. Why don't you do it this way?
Okay.
Mr. Tiffany, could you tell me what was the purpose behind the original statutory provision? What
the one, the $1,000 in 30 days?
In all of this, exactly what part of the section we're talking about, and then I think that when you tell us what the changes are, the committee members can then understand the changes a lot better if they understand what the policy was behind the original statute.
As best of our ability, going back into the history of that, there is nothing that specifies why $1,000 was set or why the time limit was set. To us, obviously, it doesn't make sense. If a wage earner has earned monies, regardless of when they earned or how much he has earned, they should be paid to his survivors. So we're asking for that change.
Okay, that the existing law then provided a mechanism by which a deceased who had wages due and owing, that individual would have that money paid to his or her surviving spouse.
That's correct.
And the old law said that all wages earned not exceeding $1,000.
The question I asked, Senator, was what happened to the $1,000 in first dollar?
Yeah. But the idea was that over $1,000 would all go according to the statute, and it had to be paid according to law and everything like that. And your First Amendment just changes it so that all wages,
exactly,
not just up in excess of $1,000.
Well, actually, the way the law reads now, before the change, is the maximum that would be paid out would be $1,000. If the wage earner had, in fact, earned $2,000 under the existing law, his survivors would only be due $1,000. We are changing that so it's all money's owed. The 30-day provision, or the 3-month provision, I mean, like the dollar amount, has really nothing to do with the fact that the person either has earned the money or hasn't earned it, regardless of when it was earned. If he's earned it and it's due him, it should be paid to his survivors. The Section 2 change.
That's still intriguing.
Why it did it in the first place?
You know, you've added some other language in there, and I don't want to run ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it appears that, just thinking about it, and I don't know, and Mr. Frederick, who is always knowledgeable about these things, sitting in the back, I notice he moves further to the back of the room as the committee starts. Is that how we tell? Those who sit in the first row know what's going on, second, third row. Sort of like a classroom. The first $1,000 would appear to me to fall within that immediately due and payable section. You know, within the 48 hours.
That's correct.
And that, the first $1,000 is payable then. I mean, it has to be paid. And the idea was to pay it to his spouse because, his or her spouse, because they're going to need money to live on.
That's right.
And the rest of it, over $1,000, would then have been paid to the estate. Isn't that correct?
That would be then subject to all the other general statutes.
All right, yeah, right. I got it now. Mm-hmm. Now, you've taken the position that all of it should be immediately due and payable.
As if the wage earner were still alive.
Okay. Right. Within that 48-hour period.
Right.
And that 48-hour period we're talking about is another statute that says all wages due and owing an individual within 48 hours after the termination of their employment must be paid to them. Okay, now the second part of that, what you've added, is you put in, or if there's no, on line 8, or if there's no surviving spouse, the dependent children in equal shares. Now, why was that added?
The existing language assumed that the wage earner had a spouse. There are a number of wage earners who are now working who are single parents or who have no spouse. And the way the law was before, if you didn't have a spouse, it was unclear where the money would go. It would go through probate or whatever else. We're just clarifying and making the law a little more applicable to an awful lot of people who are working who are parents and single parents.
Immediate concern I have is if, in fact, it's a single parent and the parent is then deceased and there's minor children, it's obvious you can't pay the money to them because they're minors. And you're going to have a guardian appointed, and you have to go through that whole procedure. Okay, I understand what they did, what you're doing. I understand the statute.
You're going to have to figure that out.
Go ahead.
Okay. In section two, when a judgment is put against an employer by the wage and hour division, and the monies are collected, they are deposited routinely with the state treasurer. In the past, we have found it difficult to get those monies released from the treasurer so that we can, in fact, pay them out to survivors. Hence, we've added section two, which means that the treasurer would disperse those funds just as quickly as if it were an employer. We have several cases that are interesting, but in fact it is difficult to get money out of the Treasury. Pardon? Yeah, why don't you? Paul has a specific case in point that's kind of interesting.
There was a situation that happened not too long ago, and this does happen from time to time, but the thing that really came to our attention was that we had collected about $5,000 on an old judgment that we had for wages that were earned to one of our wage claimants who subsequently died. When we finally did collect on the judgment, we went to disperse the money and found that we had time getting that more than $1,000 out of the state treasury then to disperse it to his estate. We hope that this language here would alleviate that problem. Any money that we collect on wage claims, we hope to get to those individuals who have earned it, or in this case, who it should go to.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wingard.
There ought to be some way to find out the legislative history on this first section, which still bothers me, as it, I think, bothers you.
It does.
There must be something there. Have you checked the legislative history on this, Mr. Huber?
We can't find any reason for the 1,000 or 3 months. It occurred.
The only thing I'm thinking is possibly, maybe I'm missing something in reading it, but the money would still be due, of course, but it's just a matter of time as to when it could be collected or something like that, right?
That's true.
This language doesn't negate the fact that money should be paid, does it?
The original language simply says, as Senator Gungowski points out, the first 1,000 has to be paid within 48 hours. Any subsequent money owed could be paid over time as the as a situation would be, but through probate or through receivership or guardianship or anything else. What we're suggesting is that the survivor needs the money at the time of death, and we are suggesting that the total amount due be paid within 48 hours.
Well, I'm thinking in terms of maybe someone has an agreement that they're only paid on a certain type of, you know, on a certain basis. This would negate that particular agreement. Now that's what I'm thinking. There could be people who,
you know, that statute
only take
quarterly income or something like that.
Well, yes, or they only take living expenses, and their whole agreement then is based on that the final amounts will be at the year end or something. You know?
Commissions and bonuses,
right,
and things like that.
And that could affect that kind of employee relationship.
I wish I were an attorney.
No, George is absolutely correct. What you're talking about is that you people enter into employment contracts all the time,
mm-hmm,
on how they're going to be paid. As you said, bonuses, commissions, or things like that, and whether, in fact, this statute written like this negates the contract, which I have problems legally if we can do.
I wonder, Senator, if the term that this amount of money on line 7, they become due and payable, does that leave an option for the recipient to say these monies are in fact due and payable, I choose not to have them dispersed at this time, or I choose to have them dispersed at this time, but in fact the monies remain due and payable, leaving it to the option of the survivor, whether the survivor wants the money now or at quarter or at year end or some other more convenient time.
See, I'm going to tell you what Senator Wingard's got me going on is the 48-hour statute, you know, also provides in another statute that if in fact that wages are not paid within that time, that there's a private cause of action against the employer, which provides that up to 30 days of the wages plus attorney fees. And though I am extremely interested in seeing that the surviving spouse and children get paid, I don't want us to put us into a position that an employer is an unworkable position for the payment of the money that's due. It's not on the basis that he isn't going to pay it, but he can't pay it within a 48-hour period. And I think, as George was trying to get at, Senator Wingard was trying to get at, was that there may be an employment contract that is set up to pay out over a different period of time, and whether this negates that particular contract.
In the 7 years you've been wage and hour, do you have any examples of that?
Well, of course we do run into that on a daily basis because of the various employment contracts and because of the 48-hour statute. The position that we've taken on those things is that, well, one of the most typical examples is a commission payment where the employee will actually have money coming to them after they quit, okay? The contracts come to fruition or what have you. And so they continue to receive a check over a period of months. Or the profit from the business is not known, and so on, okay? The way the statute's written is to, for example, in line 6, all wages earned. Wages are earned at a certain period in time. All the wages that are earned at this employee's death, for example, should become due and payable to the surviving people. That doesn't mean to say that he might not earn some more money later on down the pike in accordance with the contract, at which time when they're earned later, then they would become due and payable as well.
Okay.
But that's how we handle that. Obviously, we'd have a very bad problem, especially on commission claims, if we didn't come up with something.
Let's go ahead. You're on page 2, section 3, line 14 is the next change.
Restricted delivery is fast becoming an impossible methodology of delivering communications. We are asking that we just go by certified mail return receipt requested. We're doing that instantly in all our statutes that we have restricted delivery.
Okay. Could somebody explain to me what restricted delivery is, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Do you know what restricted delivery is? Is there anybody in the audience that knows what restricted delivery is?
Yes. I know, because
Carl just moved back one more day.
That's the mail service right now.
Right. Restricted delivery means that the postman is not authorized to deliver an article to anyone other than the addressee. It's restricted to that person and that person alone. Unfortunately, the mailmen don't really read those things sometimes, and so we wind up getting it to everybody in God's creation. And technically, under law, we don't have service. It's really becoming impossible to serve anyone that way. We just don't know whether there's any other similar restriction like that under the APA or anywhere else as far as service is concerned.
Go ahead.
On page 3, line 20, we are asking for a change increasing the amount from $600 to $2,000 to conform with the Federal Bankruptcy Act that was recently revised and adopted. The $600 limit was the old limit on bankruptcy. We're talking about an employer now who has gone into some form of receivership or other control. Line 25 on the same page, 3. D, claim labor employees.
I want you to go back so everyone understands what we've done.
Okay.
And as I understand it, the new amendment, the old bankruptcy law only allowed the recovery of wages up to $600.
Priority wage.
Priority wage.
Right.
And what you, and they've changed the law to $2,000.
Yes.
Right. And you're attempting to pick it up in the.
We're trying to conform this particular statute to that one because we have run into situations where attorneys have been advising their clients to pay the lower amount, fearing a lawsuit or some other creditor then coming in and saying you paid out more than you really
okay,
should have.
I understand.
So we'd like to conform.
Go ahead.
Line 25, we're simply desexing the statute. Next substantive change on page 4, lines 5 through 7. Here we have clarifying what an employer may deduct from a deceased wage earner's earnings. From any wage earner, for that matter, as Paul corrects me. What we're talking about here is the deduction may not be made if the ultimate receiver of that deduction is, in fact, the employer. For example, an employee may sign a voluntary deduction for locker space or some other convenience, and at that point, once death, that would be no longer a valid deduction.
I didn't want to say it.
Paragraphs D and E are redundant. We're asking that D be deleted, replaced with the new D. Talking about really a collective bargaining agreement or an employment agreement, the same thing in most cases.
No, they're not. They're entirely different.
Right.
Two separate, distinct entities. There's a collective bargaining agreement and there's an individual employment contract.
The primary reason for our request to delete D is that we feel is inconsistent with the preamble up in line one, no employer may deduct, withhold, divert any portion of employees' wages unless the deduction is pursuant to an individual employment contract. We have attempted to find out what the legislative history is behind that D, and we can't find any. We know that it was a last-minute amendment, but we're not sure there is any testimony on that particular line. The effect of it has been to raise some legal questions in various fact situations that may translate to something like this. You can't deduct, withhold, or divert unless you require your employee to sign an individual contract to do so. Basically, we're having is forcing our AGs to write all kinds of briefs and what have you to get to what we feel is the real intent of this particular statute, which is in line C, the new added language about voluntary deductions. and that is that you can voluntarily authorize something to be deducted from your wages so long as it doesn't go to the benefit of the employer. For example, many gasoline stations will require their employees upon coming to work to sign a contract that they'll be responsible for all till shortages, merchandise shortages, and so on. We don't really believe that that's a voluntary authorization, as it's a more of a condition of employment. As a matter of fact, this little section alone has generated well over 100 cases in the AG's office since it came into effect in 1977. We did do some legislative history on that particular line, C there. Employees voluntarily signed an authorization. And we believe the added language there correctly reflects the legislative intent at the time.
Which was what?
Which was that whatever the deduction is, it does not go to the employer. It does not go to the benefit of the employer. It goes to the benefit of the employee. For example, a wage assignment or something else. In the case, for example, if an employee wanted to buy some tires from his employer or something like that, there's no reason why the employer could not treat him as any other customer, paying him and then having the employee pay him as he would anyone else. You can give him a discount or whatever
he
wants.
You would prevent the employee from agreeing with the employer then to deduct that from his wages?
This would do that, yes.
Okay.
And this is a big problem, Mr. Chairman?
I don't know.
You say this has been a problem?
It's a very big problem as far as we're concerned. We can look to approximately 5,000 wage claims that we receive every year, and I would say that a good 20 to 25% of them involve deductions.
But or more. Agreed on between the employer and employee.
Many of them do start off with the initial contract. I agree to be responsible for all till shortages, all merchandise shortages, gas spillages, whatever. Okay. We find this especially true in gas stations and service industries. Other service industries such as restaurants and what have you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Josh, do you have anything else you want to
ask? No, I'm just thinking about the good old days as a service station attendant.
Go ahead on line 16 through 19.
If I could go back to line 10 for a moment, Chairman, we have an error in this paragraph. We intended to delete quite a bit of that language. Section 4 should have read, "Nothing in this section shall," and we delete from that point to line 13, "diminish or enlarge, etc."
Oh, I'm sorry. The word shall on line 10, delete the remainder of line 10, 11, 12,
and
13, then on line 13.
Through the word section, which is the seventh word.
Okay.
So it would read, "Nothing in this section shall diminish or enlarge the right of any person to assert, et cetera."
Explain it to me why you're doing that.
We're talking about withholding. We're talking about deductions there, which I think, Paul, just...
They, in a sense, if we make this change and the change in C, for example, we're talking about... withholding amounts authorized in writing by the employee to be contributed to charitable organizations, that would be a voluntary deduction. As far as the next one is dues checkoff, which is taken care of in new D, old E, up on line 9. Not otherwise prohibitable. It's just a redundant section. Those lines are redundant, we believe.
No.
No? Okay.
I'm going to tell you why. And there are a number of employees who may have deductions go to labor organizations where there is no collective bargaining agreement at all. And in fact, that what they do is that the union has not been able to negotiate a union security provision in the contract because the employer doesn't want one. And so a majority of the employees, though, still want to belong to the labor organization. And they voluntarily, on their own, sign a checkoff. And it's deducted every month. But it will not be pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement because the union hasn't been able to get it into the contract. And that's why that was put in there. And that is why I specifically put that in there 4 years ago. And that's what it addresses.
Yeah. And what you're
remember
saying,
that, Senator Hannah?
Yes, sir. Mr. Kennedy's over there hyperventilating.
Yeah.
It's apparent.
Okay. If you want the history behind that, the first part of that section, go talk to Glenn Patterson, who is the lobbyist for the Seventh-day Adventist, because that whole section is related to his organization.
That's a conscience.
It's the conscience clause.
Which
provides that, in fact, employees who have a bona fide religious objection to belonging to a labor organization and paying dues to it, which the federal law just passed as an amendment, the last amendment to the National Labor Relations Act this last December, says that those employees can pay an equivalent amount of dues to a charitable organization.
Well, I suppose if it were left there, it wouldn't diminish anything above.
No, I don't think it hurts anything. I think it should stay in. Just one person's opinion.
Section 5 is being deleted and rewritten as new Section 7 to clarify an individual's right to private action.
Okay.
And the only other change in the printed bill you have before you is the last line, page 5, line 8, a bracket was omitted, deletion bracket. In going through this bill with Paul, I was amazed to find out how many claims Wage and Hour Division gets from survivors of deceased wage earners. It seems inconceivable to me that that would be a problem. If someone dies, the employer would pay the money, and that would be the end of it. It is a problem. The changes we're making, we think, will help us be a little more efficient.
Questions? Do you have anything further, Bruce?
Well, one comment, Senator, about the this $1,000 amount. I think what I heard the committee saying was that this may pose an imposition, an undue imposition on the employer if he doesn't have money or doesn't choose to pay it out at that point. Is that a fair assessment of that problem?
I think a more accurate statement is that the committee doesn't understand why the statute was implemented and why you want to change it. And then I expressed a concern about an undue imposition on the employer.
In reviewing it, we couldn't determine why it was $1,000 or why it was 3 months. Why not $500 in 6 months? There was no discussion about this as far as being in a position on anyone. It's fairly obvious that a wage earner who has earned more than $1,000 eventually would have gotten it. The first 1,000 would go in 48 hours to the survivor. What we're suggesting is that whatever monies are owed would be paid to the survivor as if the wage earner were still alive.
George?
I would be more comfortable with raising that limit, for instance, to reflect inflation at this point. And I really see, and I think Senator Kulongoski and I have been working around the edges of this, and maybe somebody's going to testify later on it, but in a commission situation where commissions aren't due, even though they are earned, it may well be the employer doesn't have the money either, you know. And I don't, in real estate, for instance, there's a question as when the actual, if the commission is earned, yet as to when it is to be paid. And you could put in a big commission situation where some real estate deals are, you could put a employer, a broker, in quite a bind. In other words, he would have to go to the bank and borrow the money to pay the widow maybe a sum of $30,000 or $40,000 in a big real estate deal, in which the deal actually hasn't closed yet, but in essence, he had earned that commission. Now, what I'm saying, and I think the intent here is to make sure the widow has enough money to get by on, and the $1,000 probably doesn't reflect today's inflation rate. Maybe it should be three or something. I don't know, you know, I just am concerned about it. Maybe council could do some research, our council could do some research.
How do you define wages from commissions? Is there a distinction?
No, it's their wages.
We're talking about here all wages earned. Has that commission been earned in the senator's scenario?
Well, the problem with commissions is, Senator Wingard points out, there are a million ways to do it. You know, every one of them is different, and for me to make a generality would be kind of hard.
Well, in a lot of partnerships, Mr. Chairman, your share of the business commissions is not due until the end of the year, for instance. And I don't know why.
Of course, we wouldn't be talking about that situation because we'd only be talking about employees here.
Yeah.
One of the things that I know, for example, the Bankruptcy Act, the Federal Bankruptcy Act, does have a limitation, or did, 3 months, and it was wages up to $600. We always had a problem with people who earned vacations. 3 months of that was priority wages, the other 9 wasn't, and so on. This might be the origin of this limit in time. I'm not sure. We did some looking at this, and we couldn't find too much on intent.
Bruce, this isn't meant as criticism, so don't take it that way, but I think a lot of times what happens when you amend a section like this to come in to explain why you want it, unless that there's a history and an explanation of just the purpose behind the statute, it really puts us in a tough position trying to read it and to amend it when we do not understand the initial statutory purpose. And if in fact that you need to work with Rocky or somebody to find that out, it's much easier for us to make a decision up here and make the changes you want.
I appreciate that, sir. Also, the situation that we have, we don't know the intent because we can't find the intent. And approaching the matter from a compassionate point of view for the survivor is a matter of just if a person has earned the money, it's due and payable, regardless of amount and regardless of when it was earned. The problems that Senator Wingard is pointing out, however, causing a little rethinking here, and perhaps raising it would be the would be more equitable. As Senator Wingard points out, and Paul, I'm sure, concurs, the situation is that a death is traumatic and the survivors have to carry on, and we're trying to get money to them as quickly as possible. Perhaps we should look at a raising of that limit.
I think, Mr. Chairman, you take the, for instance, I think $1,000 is probably a third of what it should be, you know, at a minimum. You take a look at the average guy working in a construction business, he's going to be making a minimum of $1,000 a month, probably closer to $2,000. So, you know, I think approach that way might be well, but I'd like to see maybe if Rocky could find anything on that.
Bruce, let me ask you one last question. Has the Bureau been drafting its own bills, or have you been running them by the AG?
Both.
Have you? Has the Attorney General's office reviewed the legislation?
Yes.
Okay. There's no one else signed up for 209. Does there anybody care to testify on Senate Bill 209? Hearing none, I'm going to close the hearing on 209 and open it up on 219. If I'm not mistaken, for the committee, this bill probably is a result of 1977. You may recall that the legislature passed a bill that said it's an unfair employment practice for an employer to refuse to hire or to terminate the employment of an individual because any other member of the individual's family presently works for that employer. That passed in 77. That was the husband-wife situation. And what this bill is doing now is expanding that provision to include any other family member. As I remember the testimony back in 77, there were employers who specifically had a policy of refusing to hire the spouse of anyone that worked for them. And the legislature passed a law so that that could not be the sole reason why an employer would refuse to hire an individual. And as I said earlier, that this bill just expands it to family relationship. Is that a fair?
That's fairly accurate, Senator. There are federal laws existing on the books now that still prohibit nepotism, primarily in the area of banking or where embezzlement could be a possibility with families being involved. But this bill also enlarges the Unlawful Employment Act not only to hiring and firing, but also to discrimination in areas of compensation, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment.
Okay, now that's found on page 2, line 13, where you've added 659-227, 659-330-340.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in language on line 22 and 23, the same thing. Interesting change on line 24 at the request of the AG.
24, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Formerly worked. The employer cannot discriminate against that person's family who works for him now or who used to work for him. And it seems like a minor matter, although we do have quite a few cases of an employer firing someone and then retaliating in kind against the fired person's family.
Mr. Chairman, do you have any opposite or anyone testifying opposite to the bill?
Not right now, Mr. Senator.
I might point out, though, that the member of an individual's family is defined in federal law as all these relations found on line 37, 38 on page 2. Continue on to page 3, we're adding first cousin, grandparent, and grandchild to conform with federal law.
Okay. Circle that form and it worked. That's a good issue. I don't think anybody's aware of that. Does anyone else care to testify on 219? I'm going to close the hearing on 219, 210.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bills 210, 11, and 12 have all been submitted at the request of the Wage and Hour Commission. Okay. Senate Bill 210 simply allows the Wage and Hour Commission to issue special work permits to minors under 16 to work after 10 p.m. before 7 a.m. The Wage and Hour Commission does not have that authority at this time. They're requesting it. The Bureau concurs.
We're on Senate Bill 210.
We got rid of 219 already?
Yeah.
That's fast, isn't it?
What 210 does is it allegedly gives the Wage and Hour Commission authority that it does not presently possess to issue a special permit for the employment of certain minors after 10 p.m. or before 6 a.m.
Excuse me, Senator, it should be before 7 a.m. There's a typo in the bill summary.
I'm sorry. Before 7 a.m.
Can I ask you a question? We still have curfew laws in this state, do we not?
I think they're municipal laws. I think they are in existence in certain areas.
State curfew law.
But there are municipal.
I think so. The city of downtown Scappoose has had a curfew law a couple years ago.
How does a minor under 16 get a permit and still comply with the curfew laws?
I don't know, Senator. I don't know.
Chairman, are you sure there are curfew laws?
I think there are.
There was years ago, but I don't
know. No, we repealed the state statute on it.
I think there are still municipal curfew laws, Senator, but that's an interesting question. I don't know.
I don't even think they can increase wages out in fines. Are there any other questions?
Aren't there youngsters working after 10 o'clock at some of these fast food restaurants now or working? Are they in violation of the law then?
They're under 16, yes.
I'm sure a number of them are under 16.
16 or under, or is it under 16?
At the 16th year, they are now, they can work after 10.
So it's 15 then.
Yeah.
Right.
There are also many people working on fishing boats that leave the dock at 4 in the morning who are also technically illegal if they're under 16.
It's breaking it 30 years ago.
The reason for this particular one was this came out of the Wage and Hour Commission study it has been conducting for the last 2 years of its rules and their impact on employment opportunities for minors. There was considerable testimony before the Wage and Hour Commission that certain talented minors or minors who had special training, or minors who were out on their own earning their own living, maybe even minor parents, were being prohibited from working past 10 o'clock at night, and thus inhibiting their chance to further their economic situation. This would allow the commission to take each of those situations in individually and make a decision on each one. The one that clearly comes to mind was the kid who played some kind of saxophone or something, and his parents accompanied him everywhere he went, and he played with his other brothers and sisters and what have you, but he did so in violation because of this particular law.
Chairman.
Yes.
If this were to pass, would you, in your decision-making process, take into consideration local curfew laws, or?
I'm sure we would have to do that. There is a rule, the commission has a rule that prohibits the issuance of a work permit, any work permit, in conflict or in violation of any law. So we would have to take those into consideration.
Dick, all those paper boys.
Chairman, I would suggest that the Oregonian is in violation of the law. They got these paper boys, 15, 12, out for 6 o'clock in the morning. Has your agency taken any action against them?
I believe newspaper carriers and vendors enjoy special exemption. They are exempt from the hours provisions.
Chairman, could I request some amendments to this bill?
Is there anyone else that cares to testify on 210? Hearing none, I close the hearing on 210. Senate Bill 211.
Chairman, the Wage and Hour Commission does have authority to, in special instances, grant an employer the right to pay less than the minimum wage. Three conditions are those persons who are mentally handicapped, physically handicapped, or over 65 years of age. In reviewing our own statutes, we find that being over 65 years of age is a protected class, and this law is discriminatory. So we are suggesting that the 65-year provision be deleted, still allowing the Wage and Hour Commission to grant subminimum wage provisions for mentally and physically handicapped people. That's the deletion on line 9.
Okay.
Paul, why don't you go through this? There's, we have some errors in this thing, I think, don't we, at the bottom?
Yes. On line 15, that was legislative council, I believe, did some cleaning up in the old statute. We didn't put that in, but it appeared in the bill, so we assume that legislative council did that, put in the semicolon, the and deleted the period. Line 26, the bracket should not have started where it does if the commissioner does not prevail. That was an error on our part. The brackets really should start on the next page after the words disbursements on line 1, leading the rest of that line, and the word, the two words attorney's fees on line 2. So that particular line would read, if the commissioner does not prevail in such action, he shall pay costs and disbursements from the Bureau of Labor and Industries account. The intent here was to delete the attorney's fees.
Okay.
The reason for that is that they act as that particular situation acts as a deterrent to enforcement. The idea behind an attorney's fees, and also it is to bring it into consistency with our other statutes. Nowhere else in any other legislation that we are responsible for enforcing are we required to pay attorney's fees if we do. For example, on page 1, the first and second line there, the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries has same powers and duties in connection with a wage claim, and it cites the wage collection statute there. That's based on the minimum wage law, and then as he does under the wage collection statute,